Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, I'm John Neff, Global Editor-in-Chief of Motor One, and welcome to this week's episode of the MotorOne.com podcast. Kia this week released a teaser image of the 2021 Optima sedan that set our little corner of the internet on fire. It looks fantastic, at least what we can see of it. This is hardly surprising, though, as Kia and its corporate cousin from Korea, Hyundai, have been pumping out awesome designs for a few years now. On today's show, we're going to talk about the Optima teaser, as well as analyze Korea's unexpected rise to the top of mainstream automotive design. Joining me is managing editor Brandon Turkus. How are you doing, Brandon?
I'm doing very well.
And in the other chair is writer Christopher Smith. How are you, Chris?
Happy Halloween! Well, yesterday anyways, when you hear this.
That's right. Happy Halloween. Nothing scary on today's podcast, but we'll see by the time we get to the end. So before we get to talking about Kia, something actually happened the day before we're recording this that's really big news, and I wanted to mention it and get your thoughts on it. And that's the announcement that Fiat Chrysler is merging with PSA, the parent company of brands like Peugeot and Citroën and many others. So that was just announced yesterday, really even last night, that the merger was approved. And it sounds like another one of those merger of equals deals. But as I think we all know, it's never really that. And when the dust settles, we'll perhaps see which side turns out to be maybe the one calling the shots. Some interesting facts are emerging from this, though, that I'll throw out there before I get your thoughts. The first is that it's going to create the fourth largest automaker in the world. And the number of brands, I actually have to count them. I have them listed. It's Fiat, Jeep, Dodge, Ram, and Chrysler, Alfa Romeo, Maserati, Peugeot, Citroën, DS, Opel, and Vauxhall. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And we actually counted yesterday. That's technically one more brand than the Volkswagen Group, which to date has been, the largest in terms of just sheer number of brands. Of course, the valuable thing that FCA brings to the table is Ram and Jeep. Those are the two kind of coveted brands that FCA holds and that anyone who has talked to them about merging or acquisition has coveted. Meanwhile, FCA, which has a very, let's say, politely dated lineup of cars, gets access to PSA's kind of modern platforms for passenger vehicles. So that's kind of, and then of course they're going to get the economies of scale that come with being a much larger company and lots of savings from that. But I wanted to get your reaction. So Brandon, let me start with you. You actually, I think, found the news yesterday as soon as it happened. What was your first reaction to hearing about the merger?
I mean, as somebody that grew up in Detroit in the 1990s, anytime I hear the phrase merger of equals, I develop like a very sudden tick, and I have a little bit of PTSD from it, from the Daimler Chrysler days. This seems like a very good deal for FCA and a very good deal for PSA. I'm excited about the prospect of French cars coming back to the US. I think Peugeot and Citroën and DS have a really impressive line of crossovers. Every time I'm over in Europe, I'm consistently amazed by the number of crossovers from each brand that I see. They're absolutely everywhere over there. I think it'll be great for Chrysler, though, because there's a more developed line of electrified vehicles from those brands, and there's a very good line of commercial vehicles as well. So, and the reality is that, you know, FCA's Fiat-based commercial vehicles, the Ducato and the Duplo, which are the ProMaster series here in the U.S., are just really not that great. So I think the idea of French commercial vehicles coming over here, French crossovers coming over here, especially for the Chrysler brand, which is either going to go away or is going to become a really big deal, if they get access to PSA's line of crossovers, I think it's very exciting for them.
It's interesting that you bring up the commercial vehicles and particularly the ProMaster in the US, because pretty big into like the camper van scene, and in the camper van scene in the US, which is, you know, van life is so popular, there's three choices, right? The Sprinter, the Ford Transit, and the Ram ProMaster. And the ProMaster is really popular, and I've learned some advantages it has over the Sprinter and the Transit. One being that the interior size is larger. There's actually more interior room because the walls aren't as thick and things like that. So I'll be interested to see if they replace the ProMaster with a PSA product, or if they just bring more PSA products over to bolster their commercial vehicle lineup. Because the commercial vehicle segment has really grown way more competitive in the past 10 to 15 years. It used to be just dominated by Ford, really. And now it's every automaker is seemingly coming in to take their small piece of the pie. So that's a good observation. I wasn't even thinking commercial vehicles before, and electric vehicles as well. That was another good point, because Chrysler is nowhere in terms of electrification.
I will say I do hope the French commercial vehicles come over here, especially Citroën, because they have the best names. Like, they have two vehicles off the top of my head: the Citroën Jumpy and the Citroën Bongo. Yeah. which are just fantastic names for like small commercial vehicles.
There's no way they're going to come over with those names, though. I wish they were. But they're going to make something like ProMaster Lite, and you know.
Yeah, honestly, like I hope they come over, because I appreciate that there's a subset of people that like that appreciate what the ProMaster is, but it is far and away one of the worst driving vehicles I've ever experienced.
Huh. I haven't driven one, so I'm kind of
it's absolutely awful.
That's interesting. Well, and I think another really probably the biggest unanswered question are these European brands going to appear on U.S. shores, or is it going to be more about platform sharing and they're going to be donating platforms and cars to the American brands to sell under their names? I don't think we know the answer to that question for sure.
I don't think we'll know that answer for another 6 months, honestly.
Yeah, probably. Chris, let me switch it to you. What do you think?
You guys forgot the best Citroën name of all time, the Space Tourer. Come on. Who doesn't want to drive something called the Space Tourer? I don't know if those are commercial vans. I think those are just passenger vans.
The Space Tourer is a C4-based passenger van, I think.
Yeah, honestly, I love the way they look. And really, when we're talking about FCA and mergers, we knew something was coming eventually. I mean, FCA for the last several years, I think, has pretty much talked to everybody. I didn't get a call yet asking for a merger with me personally, but it was coming. So, I mean, we knew it was coming. And, you know, this makes a really, really large automaker for the entire world. I think we're going to see a lot more benefit to FCA in terms of some of the smaller crossovers, because really you don't see a lot of small crossovers with FCA right now.
No, you do have the Jeep Renegade and the Compass, but I mean, but certainly
once you get away from Jeep, though.
You're right. I mean, that's it. Is just really those two offerings from Jeep. Whereas,
well, the Fiat 500X, which is the Jeep Renegade, basically.
Yeah, I take your point. I mean, it's really starting to kind of split some hairs when you see automakers like offering two or three or four different small crossovers for each of their individual brands. I mean, there is no small Ram crossover. There's no Ram crossover. Period. There's just trucks.
Well, there's the Dodge. What's the
Journey, which is older than I am.
Which is entirely forgettable, which is what I just
Well, did, there's the Durango, but below that you have the Journey, which is not even worth talking about, and then below that you have nothing.
Nothing is really small, and that's, I mean, you can see that with Peugeot and Citroën especially. I think there's a really good opportunity for FCA to just, you know what, do a little bit of badge engineering. It's not like they haven't done it in the past. And it could totally work out for a really quick solution to kind of, especially if fuel prices eventually go up, you know?
I don't even think it has to be as quick and dirty as a badge re-engineering, because, you know, they took the time they needed when they merged with Fiat to start building vehicles using shared manufacturing and shared development. And you got vehicles like the Fiat 500X and the Jeep Renegade, which are differentiated completely. I mean, a layman wouldn't be able to tell that those were related at all by looking at them. So I think they can still take advantage of everything and not necessarily have to go the badge re-engineering route. I hope they don't. I think, you know, I always like it when automakers put more effort into distinguishing the products on their platform. So let me give you my reaction, because my reaction was pretty much like meh. And I'll tell you why. This is like, to me, this is like having an uncle who just gave you an invitation to his fourth wedding. It's like in the past 20 years, Chrysler has merged with Daimler, Cerberus, Fiat, and now PSA on top of Fiat. And it's just like going to this guy's wedding for the fourth time and being like, well, I'm not going to treat it like the first one, because we've done this so many times. And so I think it's interesting. I think it clearly... I don't know the specifics of FCA's situation in terms of how dire it was, but it was urgent enough that I think, Brandon, you said it, they were shopping around the industry very publicly looking for a partner for more than the past year. So I think this is a really good deal for them. As a matter of fact, I think it's a better deal for FCA than it is for PSA.
Well, I would say this, though. The one thing that I think it's really important that we keep in mind is that PSA, under Carlos Tavares, their current CEO, who will become the new, I want to say he'll become the new CEO of the joint company, has been looking at coming back to the U.S. for several years. And I'd have to imagine that they've been engineering these new platforms that they're rolling out, especially the new crossovers, with an eye towards easily federalizing them. So I think we'll see the results of this in terms of product sooner rather than later.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because, you know, you look at Fiat having come back to the U.S. Kind of in line with their merger with Chrysler. And I don't think we'd say that Fiat has been a rousing success. They're still here. But I mean, I think we're all wondering if that's going to last. Returning to the U.S. market is definitely not as easy as it sounds. It's an incredibly competitive market. So yeah, I'm super interested to see in the next 6 months if we find out, are the brands coming back? Are the products coming just through the American brands that are already here? Also, I'm really interested. Obviously, PSA wants Jeep. You can sell Jeeps in Europe, no problem. But are they going to do anything with Ram in Europe? And Europe really hasn't been, I don't know if they don't like the giant American truck, the idea of a giant American truck, or maybe they just haven't been introduced to it. Ram arrives there, what will happen?
I spend a fair amount of time in Europe, and far and away the most common American pickup truck is the Ram. They're not uncommon. Like seeing Ram 1500s on European roads, especially in northern countries. Sweden, for whatever reason, loves the Ram 1500. I've driven through Stockholm, and I've seen a dozen of them in a day.
My guess is, and this is a complete guess, the Ram represents Americana better than the F-150 and the Silverado. So like, if you're European and you're into that, like the Ram is totally the one I would go for.
Yeah, that's I completely agree. I don't think we'll see Ram go over to Europe. Maybe not in its current form, but I could definitely see this joint company engineering a smaller Ram model. You could call it a Dakota if you want. It doesn't need to be called that, but something of that size to compete with the Ford Ranger and the Volkswagen Amarok and the Nissan Navara and the entire lineup of small pickup trucks that are sold in Europe right now.
Yeah. I think that's, we already know that it's likely that Ram will, is developing a midsize pickup. Now it'll be interesting to see if PSA gets involved with that development and it becomes more of a global product than just a North American one. So let's move on to the main topic of the podcast this week, which is Kia, and in particular, the teaser that Kia released of the 2021 Optima sedan. Now, this is a midsize sedan, and the teaser that was released got a lot of reaction on Motor One. Definitely generated a lot of traffic, comments, and as far as teasers go, it actually reveals a lot of the car, particularly the front end. And, you know, from my perspective, my reaction is very positive. It's different. It looks aggressive, interesting, exciting even. Like, there's definitely, I think whether you like it or not, I definitely get the impression that lots of people are going to have an emotional reaction to this design. Chris, what did you think when you first saw the teaser?
Well, I've gone on record quite often on the podcast about not being a fan of the really large grill trend that's going on. So I look at this and I love it. It doesn't have the big grill. It's got Kia's, you know, just sharp stinger grill, the shark grill up there, the tiger grill. And it seems like every time they evolve it, they just focus it in a little bit better. I wasn't a really huge fan of that design to start with. Looking at it on this teaser, I absolutely love it. It looks very sleek. I will say I'm not really that interested in what they're doing with the headlights, with the little LED strips around it. That seems to kind of contrast. It almost has a sharpness that doesn't go with the rest of the style. I don't know how prominent that's going to be in the production car, but it's the only thing that I really have questions on thus far, and it's a small question really for me.
Yeah, I think in the teaser definitely highlights that headlight signature. So I think that'll probably blend in a little more on the production car. How about you, Brandon? What did you think when you saw it?
I think it's yet another sign of how well Hyundai and Kia in general are doing in terms of design. I mean, if you look at the Sonata and now this, there's...
Oh, the Sonata. When I first saw the Sonata, the new Sonata, I mean, such a gorgeous mid-size sedan, and it stood out to me so much because of how many automakers are exiting this segment and the car segment in general. And then you see Hyundai just put out a killer car like that. And yeah, I agree. I'm seeing the same thing with the Optima.
Well, and it's you know, it's important to note those cars are twins. I mean, they're the same platform. The Optima is to the Sonata as the Sonata is to the Optima. I think it's a very good sign that Kia can continue to take a familiar Hyundai product and put its own spin on it. And I think there are a lot of styling details here that are interesting that I'm excited to see how they shake out for the broader Kia brand. I haven't been in love with the company's design for the past few years. I think it's good, but it's never really called to me. I think this will be a really welcome injection of kind of freshness to their design language, especially in the interior. We didn't really talk about the interior sketch that they released, but it's a very clean cockpit, like very segmented with that high transmission tunnel. I really dig it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You bring up the fact that the Sonata and the Optima are sister cars sharing the same platform. They're highly differentiated in terms of what you can see and touch, but the mechanicals are largely similar underneath. What I think is interesting is that both brands have their own styling chiefs, and then there's this guy that sits above both of them as the head of design for all of Hyundai's Motor Group, and that's Peter Schreier. And it's amazing to me that you're right. Each brand gets to design their own, but they're each pushing the boundaries, I think, of design and making some really incredible designs. I'll bring up another example, the Kia Telluride and the Hyundai Palisade, two large three-row crossovers. Both look completely different. Both look great. They're both selling well. They've been received well. It's impressive to me that there's kind of two brands in the same company. They're both given the same basic building blocks. And you would think one would do a better job than the other. There'd be like a ranking between the two. But really, they're both doing so well in terms of design. It kind of boggles my mind because I don't, that's not what I expect, especially like you said, kind of growing up, in the 90s and watching the, US automakers with their many brands and how they just stepped all over each other or didn't try at all and just pumped out the same car with different badges. This is how you do, multiple cars on the same platform.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, that's what we got used to, right? When you look at it. And really, I'd say it started back in the 70s and into the 80s, especially with GM with their badge engineering. I mean, it was literally the same vehicle, the same sheet metal, just with different badges, some different trim. And the idea was, we'll bump you up the chain. We'll start you in something that looks identical, but it isn't quite as plush, isn't quite as fancy. And then, you know, we'll start generally with the Chevrolet, and then we'll move you up to the Pontiac, and then we'll move you up to the Oldsmobile, and then we'll move you up to the Cadillac. And
They were certainly planning on buying a lot of cars. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was the case of, okay, we're going to hold this person for their life. And, you know, starting in their 20s, they'll have this. In their 30s, they'll have this. In their 40s. And that's the formula we got used to. So when we see Hyundai and Kia, they're not exercising that formula. They're using the same vehicles underneath, but they are catering, in my opinion, to completely different tastes and even completely different audiences. And you see that right here with this Optima teaser and the Sonata. The Sonata has the big grill. I'm not as big of a fan of the Sonata, but I think the Sonata is
designed more with elegance, and I think this Optima looks like it's designed more with aggressiveness.
Right, and it's amazing to think that they're the same car, but they're not at the same time. So, well done, South Korea. Well done.
Yeah, and you look at how Hyundai, the parent company, Hyundai Motor Group, has set up these two brands. These two brands, I would say, they compete. They compete directly with each other.
It's not even about the compete directly. There's a genuine rivalry. Like, you can't talk to like Hyundai PR people about Kia because they just want nothing to do with it. And it's in the most professional way, but there's a healthy culture between those two companies that, you know, the money comes from the same wallet, but they are competing with each other.
And you know, what you described in the 80s and 90s, Chris, about the U.S. automakers were where GM wasn't trying to get their brands to compete against each other. They were trying to get the brands to each have their own kind of identity and price range so you'd move up through them. And I would say that was largely a complete failure in terms of a sales strategy, where here you have... Although I would still argue GM is still executing that strategy, even just with fewer brands, you know, Chevy, Buick, Cadillac, and GMC, they're still trying to position them so that they don't compete with each other. But I think the Hyundai, their system has worked out much better for them, where they basically have two brands competing directly against each other, and both have been growing sales like crazy for over a decade. So, you know, it's not, I think it's not as simple as just, you know, their strategy versus GM's. Obviously, there's a lot of cultural stuff, and it's probably some really good leaders there for the South Korean companies, too. But every generation, Kia and Hyundai get better and better. And it's almost like it's like clockwork. It's been really fun to watch, because I think now they're getting to a place where they're starting to have fun. And you look at like the Kia Stinger as an example of that, where that's not a car maybe where the business case was there, but maybe there were other factors. And I love seeing that, you know, because those can turn into huge hits. You look at Ford and like the Raptor, you know, I'm sure before they launched the Raptor, they weren't quite sure how that was going to go. And it turned into a huge success. So I absolutely love seeing them do this. And to go back to my earlier point, I like cars. I like crossovers too, but I don't think that crossovers have to exist at the expense of cars. I think the reason Ford and GM have not been selling well in terms of their passenger cars has been because they haven't been making good passenger cars. I don't think it's because the market is just moving wholesale away from cars into crossovers. If you look at Camry and Accord and Optima and Sonata, you know, they're doing well, or at least holding their own, because they're better products. And, you know, Ford let Fusion and Focus all kind of wither on the vine and get older, and they just watched as the sales got lower, and then they used that as an excuse to cut them.
Well, it's very easy to rationalize something like that when you don't care.
Yeah,
I mean, it's exactly. It's really easy to come up with rationalization, like, oh man, these products aren't. You know, it's never that your products are bad. It's that oh, the market just doesn't want them anymore.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Which is such a just a load of crap.
It's really a very American automaker thing, though. I mean,
it's not our fault. It's your fault.
Yeah, it's like, precisely.
It won't be uncovered. It won't be shown the light of day. The falseness of that until they're probably until gas prices go up or some other factor craters SUV and pickup truck sales, and suddenly the Americans are left with no cars.
Honestly, I think what's going to happen is, you know, you look back at the past 50 years of car buying, and in the 60s and 70s everyone bought station wagons, and then there's a station wagon backlash, everyone bought minivans. There's a minivan backlash, everyone bought SUVs. Gas prices went up, so there was an SUV backlash. Now they're getting into crossovers. And I think eventually we're going to reach a point where buyers are coming up and saying, you know, I don't really want a crossover like what my mom and dad have. I want a coupe or a sedan or a hatchback even. So I think the market is cyclical enough that we're going to see some sort of body style that's fallen out of favor, and my God, I hope it's station wagons, that comes back with a new generation of buyers. Maybe when, you know, people that are teenagers today, 15 years from now, when they can afford a really nice car, they'll say, well, you know what, I want a wagon.
Brandon, you're absolutely right. And to follow up on that, what has existed throughout all of these decades where people went from wagons to minivans to SUVs to crossovers, what's always been in the background? Sedans. And now Ford and GM are ready to walk away from that segment. They're not going to have anything to fall back
on. Now,
it really hasn't been cyclical, because if you're just going back to the wagon, you followed it its through line, you know, wagon to minivan to SUV to crossover. It hasn't returned to anything that is left yet. So I don't know.
It doesn't mean that it won't.
It doesn't, but there's no evidence that it will either. I'm just saying it's not really cyclical. I don't know what's next. I don't know what's after the SUV. I don't know if it's another body type or if it's a jump to electrification and that, you know, brings with it its own body type. You know, it could be anything, but I think we all know it's not going to be crossovers forever. And here again, we have the Americans going all in, putting all their chips on a body type and pickup trucks.
No, I'm going to take the devil's advocate position real quick and say that we have one thing now that we did not have in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and even the 2000s, and that's modular platforms. You look at what Ford is doing with its paring down to 5 modular platforms. They're going to be more agile in the way that they can develop vehicle types. So it might not be a, you know, say it's 5 or 6 years to develop a new product from like clean sheet design to on sale date. That might get cut down significantly now that, you know, we have automakers that have modular front drive platforms, modular rear drive platforms. So it might be that they think that they are more agile and able to respond to a sudden change in the market like that. Do I think it's a good idea to get rid of all sedans and cars in general? Absolutely not. I think it's a terrible idea. But I think the automakers see it as, you know, we're leaner and more agile now, and we can respond to the market quicker than we ever have before.
Even still, though, having that agility is still not going to be enough. One,
I agree.
Or especially 2 bad years in this market can kill an automaker, kill even a giant automaker. And we saw that, what, 10 years ago?
But I was at a Ford dealership about a month ago, and I asked the salesman, what do you think about Ford getting rid of all of its cars? And he said, I absolutely hate it. And one reason was because he said, now for any size vehicle I sell somebody, it's going to be more expensive because it's a crossover. And that makes the vehicle harder for me to sell. And he also admitted with a little bit of shame that he said, the problem is I can sell somebody a more expensive vehicle, but it puts them in a worse financial position. And Americans just aren't financially intelligent enough to recognize that that's a bad thing.
Oh, God, we could have Wait, we could have 10 podcasts about like the problems with new vehicle purchasing, like especially right. in terms of like my buying point and was, financing.
He felt bad because it's his job to sell cars. It's not his job to like talk people out of them. So of course he's going to sell the crossover that costs $5,000 more when they could have bought the sedan or the wagon or the tall hatchback, whatever, that costs less. And so he was kind of bemoaning that. And I think just a lack of choice. I think when he saw it as, you know, the more choice is better for him because he can find the right car for people.
So you mean my neighbors that are buying the $70,000 pickup trucks, you know, while they're also clearly not able to afford much else, you mean they're being upsold into those pickup trucks? That can't be.
Yeah,
no, that can't be right.
I will say, yeah. I mean, there were just stories coming out that this was earlier this week, that the 60-day delinquency rate for auto loans is past where it was in the housing collapse.
Yeah, I've been seeing stories like that the next financial crisis.
And it's not going to be as
subprime
bad.
Car loans.
It's not going to be as bad because, you know, it's cars versus real estate. Real estate's always going to be
right.
Bigger.
Yeah, you're not going to lose your house.
But it's still going to be very bad.
If fuel prices for some reason jump, it will be just as bad. If not worse.
Oh yeah.
If not worse. I think that's the same road again.
And the thing is, fuel prices will go up. They always go up. It's always going to happen. And yeah, like I said, I think it's short-sighted. I think the automakers see it maybe with a little bit of hubris that, you know, we can respond to this. And again, in their defense, the market is not going to change overnight necessarily. There's going to be signs that people are starting to abandon crossovers. And we'll start to see sedan concepts come out and coupe concepts and automakers trying to stumble on the next big thing.
That's what I think what I'm going to be looking for is signs for what is the next big thing. Cause I don't know that it'll be a return to something or something new or what. I'm really interested to see when the cracks start showing in crossover popularity, what is going to be the thing that causes those cracks?
Station wagons, people, bring them on, bring on all the nice station wagons.
Well, I wanted to finish our talk of Kia and Hyundai, with a little round table of some of our, favorite, Korean designs, but before we get to favorites, there was a vehicle I can pinpoint when I first started noticing that Korean designs were getting good, and I wanted to have you guys tell me yours as well. I'll start with mine to set the stage. So it was actually before Peter Schreier arrived at Kia. What popped into my head was the 2002 Hyundai Tiburon. Now there were like two or three generations of Tiburon before 2002 and they were terrible. Really they look like fish on wheels.
You're thinking of the Ferrari 550 lookalike, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Exactly. And it was what I perceived as, Hyundai going from kind of immature, silly designs to a mature design, like they were trying to be serious. And I really, really liked it at the time. I was a lot younger, but I, you know, for a coupe, it just looked really, really sharp, almost sophisticated, which at the time you would just never, ever apply an adjective like that to a Hyundai design at the time. So I give them really big props for that. And then the other one I point to, and I think this is probably the more common one, is the 2009 Hyundai Sonata. There was, the Sonata went from just probably the blandest sedan design you could think of to something that was so expressive. Lots of curves, not a straight line on it. And that's when it started. That's when the Sonata got that, chrome line that goes from like the headlight all the way up to the A pillar. That's when I think was one of the kind of first designs that ushered in this era of really great, South Korean automotive design. Brandon, what about you? What was the first Korean design that really struck your eyeballs?
I mean, it's hard to say because I'm weird in that I liked some of the older terrible ones. Like I want to say it was I don't even remember what year it is, but it was an Elantra in the 90s, and it was a neat piece of design. I don't know what it was that I really liked about it, but in terms of more modern stuff, it has to be the Optima. I mean, from the time it rolled out, I thought the Optima was maybe not the most interesting, but the best looking Korean car on the market. You get an Optima SX in white with like the sunroof or the blacked out roof or whatever, and It looked like a stormtrooper on wheels. It was a very, very cool looking car. And not just the exterior design, the interior design was really interesting too. You had these really nice quilted leather seats that...
Now, are you talking about the third generation one that lines up with the Sonata that I was just talking about? So like 2010?
Yes, that one, but also a little bit beyond that, the fourth generation one, which is on sale right now, which was a very modest redesign. It was a very, very light redesign. But yeah, both of those cars are, it's just so good looking. And it's not super exciting. It's just, you see one drive by and
just
it's
handsome.
Like, that's a good looking car.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Chris, what about you?
I'm gonna jump around here a little bit because I just have a lot to say on this that I think is relevant. You guys remember the Hyundai Scoop back from the mid '90s?
Hell yeah, I remember the Hyundai Scoop.
I've never heard of that car.
I'm not gonna pick that as the one that made me go wow, but I clearly remember that just for. Hey, it was this kind of sporty looking two door. I remember a guy that I was working with in a job at high school. He managed to get one, and it was yellow, and it just got lots of attention. But he was just out of high school. I don't know how he afforded it, but I remember he stopped driving it all of a sudden. And then one day he was like, "Yeah, I got it parked in my barn because the repo guys are looking for it." So that kind of left an impression on me.
So people were making bad financial decisions about their cars back then, too?
I think people have made bad financial decisions about their cars for decades. But for that just stuck into my mind. It's like, it's like, how rough do you got to be, you know, hunted by the repo guy for your Hyundai?
Right,
You know, back in the 90s, I mean, these cars were like crazy cheap back then. And that kind of segues to what I'm going to say next. My wife almost leased a Hyundai Elantra in the late 90s. Brandon, you were talking about that Elantra. And it was a good-looking car. And I remember, I think they also had the GT5 door around that same time. It was a great-looking car. She didn't lease it because the Hyundai dealer in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I don't know if you guys are still around, but you were just like the worst salespeople ever as far as you know, treating women with respect. So she went over to the Mitsubishi dealer and got a Mitsubishi Mirage. That's how bad the Hyundai dealer treated her. She got a 97 Mitsubishi Mirage.
Hopefully the Mirage was better back in 1997. I don't remember specifically, but it couldn't have been worse than the Mirage today.
You know, I mean, the dealership offered a really good lease deal. And I mean, she was, you know, just young in college at the time. And I mean, no, it wasn't that great. It was.
Oh, no, I just looked up the 97 Mirage.
It was slow. It was slow. I was driving Toro shows at the time, so she was used to that. She'd get in the Mirage, and so it's like, oh, this doesn't go anywhere. But yeah, I mean,
no Toro show.
I mean, it sort of had the. I think back then the Mirage was still really closely tied to the Lancer at that point.
It was, yeah.
Which we couldn't get in the States. So you know, I always thought, hey, check me out, I'm driving an Evo. And no, I'm really not. But
well, let's keep rolling with you then, and get your favorite Korean design of all time.
Not just the first one you remember, but the favorite. I see, this is where it's tough. What really turned my head to say, hey, South Korea is getting pretty legit. I rather like the fifth gen Sonata, the one that you just called the most boring. I actually rather like that. It was
that's a bad take.
But there's more here to it than that, though. There's more to it. It's a fairly sedate design. It kind of reminds me of a Camry of the period. But, you know, I rather just kind of liked the simpleness of it all. There was an article that Car and Driver did in 2007 about speed cameras in Arizona. And the focus of that was this Hyundai Sonata that got caught by a speed camera going 147 miles an hour.
Was it even capable of it?
That was the question. And that was like, holy crap, this Sonata's doing 147 miles an hour? This Hyundai? Really? It goes that fast? So that turned my head. And that made me look closer at Hyundai. And honestly, I've loved that fifth gen Sonata ever since.
I know.
So I've got to credit that for saying, hey, that's what woke me up.
I don't begrudge you that, because I think that generation, the one before I picked, it was super clean. It was super like You're right. Simple. Elegance is a strong word, but
it was clean. It wasn't dynamic, but it was clean. When you go back to the fourth gen, that just it had those kind of awkward.
Oh, the fourth gen was like
ovalish headlights. Yeah. The fifth gen was pretty clean, and if not, you know, exciting, not exciting in any measure. But man, the fact that people were asking, can this car even go 147 miles an hour? I think that was some of the best unintended PR that Hyundai may have ever got.
Can I rephrase my answer? Because I've had a think, and I know what my new answer is. And it wasn't even a car that you could buy, but it was a car that made me realize the Koreans are starting to get it. And it was the Santa Cruz concept. The small pickup truck. And it was such a cool piece of design, so interesting. And I'm still upset that they haven't built the damn thing.
Well, it's supposedly still on its way to production, but at this point, I don't know
I'm going to be able to collect Social Security by the time it comes out.
Yeah. No, that's a great choice in terms of the concepts. Definitely one of my favorite too. Chris, is that your favorite?
It's not my favorite, but I have to acknowledge it in this case has my favorite because that's the car that really woke me up to South Korea and to Hyundai and to Kia and to realize, hey, these aren't kind of joke cars anymore. I had the occasion to drive a Kia Sophia way back in the 90s when I was going to college. I worked for a used car dealer. That car was scary. I was in a light rain shower. It sounded like I was in a hailstorm. I mean, it was just
they were practically disposable.
It was such an odd experience to be in a car like that. And this wasn't an old car. And then I managed to drive a Kia Rio a few years later, and that car was pretty terrible. But even by that standard, it was a lot better. And then when I got into a Soul sometime later. This is actually pretty good.
All right, so before we get off Korean, I do want to give a shout out to my favorite Korean design, which you just mentioned, Chris, which is the Soul. I will admit, I owned one for a little while. We had a 2014 Kia Soul for a few years that we really enjoyed. But even that was a second gen. Even before that, the first gen I thought was... an exceptional design that was really fun. And it was one of those designs, I talked about eliciting an emotion before. And I think it elicited lots of positive emotion from people. It wasn't like a Mustang where you that was nostalgic or aggressive. It was fun. And I think people really gravitated towards that. And the Soul was introduced among kind of a sea of other kind of boxy hatchback competitors, all of which are gone now, and the Soul remains. And not just that, but the Soul is one of, if not the best-selling Kia vehicle every month. Like, that's how successful that design was, and it's now in its third generation. Practically created a segment for Kia that it definitely didn't exist at the time, and it took Hyundai a long time to field something in that that same segment. So good on them for that. All right, I want to move on to talk about last week's podcast because we had some feedback, some listener comments that I wanted to read and then get your reaction to. You guys weren't on the last episode with me when we talked about the Volkswagen Golf 8, and that's what all the reaction was to. So I'll come to you guys after we go through the comments. So the first comment is from a reader named Steve, and he says, "If Volkswagen doesn't send the base Golf 8 here, it won't satisfy my needs. I would definitely miss it. And if it doesn't come here, I'll have to buy a GTI." And then another commenter, Dimitri, responded, which is kind of exactly how I would respond, which is, he says, "I think that's exactly what they'd be banking on. If they don't offer the base Golf, then many VW lovers will have to pay for the next tier up, even if they don't necessarily want a performance-oriented car. More money for them while not having to pay to offer more cars here." I largely think that that's kind of true because the GTI and the Golf R together were outselling the base Golf 8 here in the US. So clearly people who wanted Golfs were bypassing the regular Golf anyway. So I think if they don't sell it here, US consumers aren't really going to miss it. But let me read another comment from a gentleman named Oliver. He says, I drive a Mark 6 Golf for the very reason that many here dislike it. It's an understated, overlooked, and generally invisible car that even in base form outmaneuvers and outdrives many performance cars. It fits in small parking spots, it holds nearly as much stuff as the average small SUV, and it gets much better fuel economy than most of them. It's also much higher quality than most in places that matter, like interior. So he makes a good point. I think that's a good reason a lot of people like Golfs is because they're kind of just understated and a little classier than some of the small cars that are available in the U.S. But the Golf 8, everybody seems to have generated a reaction to it. So let me get yours. Brandon, what do you think about the Golf 8 that debuted a couple weeks ago, and particularly about the possibility it might not be sold here in the U.S.?
I mean, I'm fine with it. It kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, cars and sedans and hatchbacks and how they're kind of fading out of the U.S. market. In the case of the Golf, I've always found it to be a very good car, but kind of an obsolete car because Americans have never been big on hatchbacks, and the ones that are have no problem going to the GTI, and the Jetta has always existed to fill that small car need. So am I disappointed by it as somebody that likes European cars and especially likes European hatchbacks? Yeah, I absolutely am bummed that it might not be sold here, but we'll still get the GTI, we'll still get the Golf R, and that's really, you know, that's one of those rare cases where in terms of the heart of a car, it's in the performance models like that. That's where the volume goes. That's where the money goes. The overall design I like. I think it's very attractive. I think the interior is gorgeous. It's smart. It's tech forward. It has, you know, the same right size blend of, you know, space and such a small footprint. So I'm eager to drive it at some point.
You know, I pretty much agree with Brandon, and, you know, I got to agree with Oliver as well. Oliver, you're spot on your comment. It fits in small parking spots. It holds nearly as much stuff as the average small SUV. It gets better fuel economy. If the Golf was lifted a little bit, it would probably sell a lot better. Because
don't give them any ideas.
we could have a safari Golf, couldn't we? Come on. We could do this.
What was the – I mentioned it.
Call it the Golf episode. Safari.
Yeah, there was the lift. What was the lifted Golf in the 90s? I mentioned it in the last episode, the Synchro Golf or something.
No, I can't remember. But the point there is, you know, hatchbacks have always been a four-letter word in the United States. They've always been regarded as just the cheap, basic entry car, which is why they never really took off and why companies are still struggling. And, you know, for Volkswagen to not send the base Golf here, I mean, the sales support that. The GTI and the R, I think they outsell 2-1, if not more,
yeah,
versus the regular Golf. So, yeah, the person that would buy the regular Golf, they'll step up to the GTI.
You know,
and really, it's not a huge, it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be a huge price difference.
No, because actually the Golf kind of had a premium of a price in the hatchback segment anyway. You know, I think this is, you know, rare, if not has never happened before, where a company has pulled the regular version of a car and kept the performance models in a country rather than the other way around.
It shows just how devoted Volkswagen,
the GTI Volkswagen and R fans, yeah,
and just how well regarded those cars are as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'd love to hear what you think about, not only last episode, but this episode, the Koreans, the FCA merger, all of that. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at MotorOneCom, where this discussion and many more will continue. And of course, go to our website, MotorOne.com, where you can find us in the comments. Now, coming up, you'll find out what we've all been driving this week. Before the break, though, a reminder that if you're listening to this online, you can also get our show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get podcasts. So please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a show. Welcome back. During this part of the show, we talk about what cars we're driving this week. And today we're going to start with you, Brandon. What have you been driving?
Well, I have been spending a great deal of time with the new Lincoln Aviator Grand Touring Black Label. It is the most expensive Aviator money can buy. The example that I had was about loaded for, I want to say, $88,000 or $89,000. So not cheap by any stretch, but...
And this is the Lincoln version of the Ford Explorer, right? So, to give people a relative size.
Yeah, that would... Yeah, in terms of size, it's I'll go into why that's not really a great argument anymore in a minute, but I put a lot of miles on this thing. I normally drive press cars about 150 to 250 miles a week. I put 900 miles on this car in a week. Drove it to Wisconsin and back, drove it all over southeastern Michigan. I spent a lot of time with this car. And honestly, it's an incredible vehicle if you think about where Lincoln as a brand was even just 5 years ago. It is supremely quiet on the freeway, and the ride is fantastic. The interior is gorgeous. The audio system is to die for. It's a 28 speaker Revel audio system. They're 30-way seats. I mean, there really wasn't a thing that this vehicle offered that there wasn't a thing I was left wanting for with this vehicle. And it's powerful too. I mean, 500 horsepower,
this is the one that's,
630 pound feet of torque. It from a plug-in hybrid powertrain with a V6 engine.
Did it feel that powerful? Because I've read reports that it doesn't feel like it's 500 horsepower.
Yeah, vehicle. It doesn't kick your teeth in, but it is more. There's more than enough power for what most drivers will need with it. If you need to execute a pass, it will make the pass. And around town, the electric torque means it feels much quicker than it really is. So if you got to shoot a gap in traffic, it can do that. The thing I was really excited about to when I was driving it, though, was to see how it what kind of fuel economy the plug-in hybrid powertrain would deliver. And like I said, I drove this thing far and wide. I'd say probably 80% of the miles that I put on it were on the freeway. But I had the cruise control set at 80 miles an hour, and I mean, I was cooking. I was moving along with some speed. So with the taking advantage of the plug-in powertrain, I did about 25% of my mileage on electric power alone. It's rated
really. That's a lot because its range is only like
it's only 20. Miles. It's only I was seeing 21 miles, but I'm fortunate that I work from home and I kept it plugged in when I was, you know, driving around. So with that range calculated in, I was getting about 27 miles to the gallon. But if you take the electrification out of the equation and just put it on the freeway at 80 miles an hour, by the time I got done, I was averaging about 19.5 miles per gallon, which isn't great when you think about a plug-in hybrid, but I think for the size of the vehicle and the level of power, it's not unreasonable.
There's always two kinds of plug-in hybrid vehicles out there. There's ones that have that technology for fuel efficiency and others that have it for power. And I think this is
the latter case.
Right. And I just drove the BMW 745e, and it was the same thing. It actually had not good fuel economy. It wasn't even the most fuel efficient 7 series. The base 7 series gas without any electrification is actually more fuel efficient than the 745e after the range ends. So that doesn't surprise me. But it's actually a really cool wave, I think, for Lincoln to get incredibly impressive power numbers, like 500 horsepower. And nobody saw that coming when they announced that, and I think it all kind of made us gasp. Well,
and in terms of that electric range, like I had enough range that I attended a backgrounder earlier this week for a product that I can't talk about yet. You'll find out about it soon. But it was about 16, 17 miles away, and I made it there on a single charge. And if you have the ability to charge up at your workplace, this is a vehicle. It's not great EV range, but it's enough that you could dramatically cut down on your fuel.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I mean, when you said 19, my first thought was, sheesh, my old 25-year-old 5-liter old technology Mustang gets 20 on the highway. But when you talk about it that way, you're absolutely right. Running around in town, local, you know, shorter distances, it's all electric.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of agree, but I think, again, it was made for power. Like 18 miles
it's absolutely made for power.
Okay. But the amount of people who are also going to have a charging station at their workplace is very, very small.
But even if you don't, you have enough electric range to cut your gas use in half, basically.
Yeah. Perhaps in half, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's... And when you factor that in, it becomes a little bit easier of a pill to swallow. But here's why I wouldn't get the Grand Touring. And it's an issue that we had in the Explorer. It's an issue that I had when I drove the Aviator Grand Touring at the launch event back in August, is the integration between the gas electric powertrains is just not quite, they're not quite on the same page. It's kind of like they're speaking two very similar but different languages. So like Portuguese and Spanish. Mm. Where you get you go to step on the pedal and especially if you suddenly apply throttle, it's not sure what power source it should be using. So you get this weird stumbling before the power kicks in, and it just doesn't respond that well to sudden changes. So if you come to a stop and then go to take off from a light and give it too much gas or too much accelerator, it kind of stumbles like, oh, you wanted electric. Oh, no, now you want gas. What do I do now? And
well, so that doesn't surprise me, actually.
Yeah.
Because think about Ford's experience with plug-in hybrids before this. It was all with their energy vehicles, which were four-cylinder cars with very little power. Now you're talking about jumping from that to many hundreds of horsepower more.
Well, there are also mechanical reasons in the approaches that they take versus a four-cylinder plug-in like that. So if you talk about I talked about this in my first drive of the Ford Escape Hybrid. There are different technologies and different layouts of the hybrid architecture from the four-cylinder Escape to the, which uses a single speed, I want to say it's ECVT, an electronic CVT, to a vehicle that uses a 10-speed automatic transmission. It has to tow. And so there are definitely made compromises to allow the vehicles to tow and do all this stuff. And some of that was refinement. And I think they'll sort that out as time goes on. But for now, I think the main issue is that it's just very different technology than what they've done before.
And that's actually a good point about the transmissions, because I remember having done some research on the electronic CVT that Ford used, because it was basically the exact same transmission.
Yeah, it was a planetary gear set in the Prius.
Yeah. And it's very clever, very high tech in how it blended the power from an electric motor and an engine. And I don't really know the mechanics of how a stepped 10-speed automatic deals with power from two sources. So yeah, that's interesting. I'm interested to see if they work that out, or if it's kind of a function of just the different mechanics of that type of transmission versus.
I will say, based on my conversations with Ford, is I think they're very aware of the refinement issues, and I think it's something that they're going to actively work on. But I think they're seeing it as, well, this is just, you know, the price that we have to pay for the time being to get these hybrid powertrains in these vehicles.
Yeah, and look, they put a great number up on the scoreboard with the power, you know, 500 horsepower. So I think they're hoping that gets people in the door and to try it out. All right, well, let's, Chris, I'm going to hop over you, because you told us before the show that you haven't really driven anything new in the past week. So don't think I'm ignoring you.
I mean, I haven't really driven anything new. I did do a little bit of off-roading in my Mazda 6, my 2004 Mazda 6.
Of course, that sounds appropriate.
I'm 40 miles from Badlands National Park in western South Dakota, which, I mean, if you've never seen it, it's an amazing place to be. But if you go just a little bit south of there, you get into the White River Badlands, which is still Badlands. It's just there aren't paved roads to really access it. So there's a really kind of a snaky little dirt road that turns into a two-track that, if you go even further, they say the high clearance is recommended, which is why I didn't go further. The only thing preventing me was the Mazda 6 sits a little low, but... you know, just a reminder that you can explore a lot of places and you don't need a crossover to do it. You don't need a pickup truck to do it. You don't even need a tremendous amount of ground clearance to do it. I was in some areas where, you know, I had to keep my wits about me, but the little front wheel drive Mazda took me to one of the most extraordinary places I've ever seen.
That's awesome. Can you camp out there? Can you stay there overnight?
Yes. Badlands National Park, you can pretty much camp anywhere. I think you need to have permits to do it. There are all kinds of hiking trails. Going a little bit further south, you get onto the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So that's, you know, things are a little different down there.
Right.
But
I ask because
all kinds of camping out here.
Like I mentioned, my wife and I are really into camper vans, and we're always, you know, looking at YouTube videos. And, you know, some of them, they would put lift kits on. There's obviously four-wheel drive sprinters you can get and things like that, just for that purpose. So you can go a little bit off-road, get a little bit away from people, mm-hmm. And find your own spot. So that's good to hear.
Yeah. Come on out.
Absolutely. I'm totally coming out. All right. So last week, or actually this week, what I have right now, what I'm driving is a 2019 Audi A7. And I was really excited to get the keys to this because obviously, you know, we drive a lot of new vehicles every year. And I still remember when I first drove an Audi A7 of the first generation one. And it was easily one of my favorite cars of that year. And I still remember it because of how much I liked it. It was one of the few cars that, as like an automotive journalist, I've driven and said, like, I could drive that every day. I could give up driving media vehicles and reviewing cars and just drive this car. I was a really big fan of the first gen. So this current generation, for me, has not lived up to the impression that the first generation gave me. I think one part of it is the exterior styling. I think that first generation, including both the original and they kind of did a refresh a little that tweaked the headlights. That design was just one of my favorites of all time. It was so good looking, not a sharp edge on it. It was all curves. And looked so long and perfect with that hatchback and sloping roof in the rear. I just loved it. And this current design is a lot of creases, a lot of sharp edges. And to me, and I've kind of complained about this before concerning Audi designs, is Audi just kind of takes a design and just kind of keeps evolving it every generation, but never really takes a risk or reinvents it, or they just keep tweaking it and keep tweaking it. And I think eventually they get farther away from what made it beautiful in the first place. And I think that's, for me, what has happened to the A7. I don't think it has the same proportions as the original that I love so much. I don't think it the design is as elegant or iconic. I think it has just kind of suffered that same fate of many Audis, which is just going through the Audi ringer, design ringer, too many times.
I am going to disagree with that.
Okay.
I think they've evolved it well. I do agree that sometimes Audi could stand to be a little bit more revolutionary than evolutionary, but in terms of the proportions, I mean, they're very similar from the first gen to the second gen. And in terms of I think they've modernized the design a bit, and I get that might not be everyone's cup of tea, but I really, really like this car. I think it's better looking than the first gen one by a pretty fair margin.
But see, I don't think adding creases and sharp angles equals modernization. Like, to me, they're just,
I mean, did they add that many though? I mean,
yeah. Go park them side by side. Yeah, I've been looking at pictures the last few days, and it's I'm not going to say it's vastly different. I'm just going to repeat what I said, in that it's just the same thing Audi does. It just starts playing with it, and making, to me, it's more about they're just making changes for making changes' sake. They're not making it look better or more modern. It's like they hit a bullseye on the first throw, and they decide, you know, rather than being happy with that, they're just going to keep throwing.
I mean, we'll agree to disagree on that one.
Yeah, I'll fall in the middle on that because, John, you have a good point, but I still think it's a good-looking car. I don't want to call it ugly.
I'm not saying it's an ugly car. I think if they had come out with this first and the first generation had never come out, I'd probably say it's a great-looking car.
And that's saying a lot for me because I hate these big grills. So
yeah, it is a big grill car for sure. Now, inside, it's totally different. I mean, the first gen interior was great for the day, but modern Audi interiors are amazing. They're excellent. So inside is absolutely a wonderful place to be. Now, this one is $83,000. So it's about as much as the Lincoln Aviator Grand Touring you were driving. But it's just the regular A7, just has the regular 3-liter V6. So yeah,
I will say,
high price to pay.
I drove an A6 earlier this year, and I was blown away with the way it drove. I thought was probably one of the best driving cars in the Audi lineup. It had just the right amount of power. The transmission tuning was great. The chassis tuning was excellent. It was really nicely balanced between agility and ride comfort. And it was a car that I just wanted to spend more time in. Do you feel that way about the A7?
Because they are
mechanical twins.
Right. They are mechanical twins. I don't necessarily disagree with everything you just said. Like I think all of that's pretty much true. However, I also feel like that's sort of been true of most Audis and honestly Mercedes-Benz and BMW. It's like that's their thing, to get the balance between ride and handling perfect so that there's no sacrifice on either end. And I think depending on the decade, the generation of car, they may, you know, succeed or fail at that to some degree, but more so than almost any other automakers, they manage to get that balance right. So I can say, yeah, it drives really, really well. The engine and transmission are perfect dance partners. All of that is true, but I guess for me, that's like a minimum bar for Audis, BMWs, and Mercedes is they should get that. I don't get the feeling like I want to get in it and go drive for fun. I more get the feeling that I'm happy to get in it to drive when I do, but it doesn't like beg me to go out, you know, driving with no purpose, just for fun. But that might be personal taste too, because I might have said the opposite about the first gen A7 because I remember it being the smoothest driving car I had driven at the time. Just like it was almost so quiet. It was like an EV. Its throttle kind of sensitivity and reaction to throttle was just so linear and smooth. It was just. That's what I remember from that first A7. And I drove many A7s after that, of that generation too. And of course, their personalities change as you go up the ladder to S and RS and all that. But yeah, honestly, I love the A7. I think it was a great idea. It spawned. It wasn't the first car of that type. I think we'd give that to the Mercedes CLS class. But I think it instantly became one of the best ones in the segment and remains to that day. Clearly, I think you're hearing, though, that I had a really high bar for the current A7 that is struggling to beat the bar that my memory sets of the first one. All right, so that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow Chris Smith on Twitter at @chwriting, Brandon Turkus at Brandon Turkus, and me at John_M_Neff. I want to thank you two for being here co-hosting with me.
Gentlemen, always a pleasure.
All right, and thank all of you out there for listening. We'll see you next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.